On that, Dick, actually, you talked about the superannuation fund boards. There are different types of superannuation fund boards. So when you're with NAB, you've got a whole management team which are working outside of where you're, of what you're responsible for. So you're a fiduciary board, aren't you? You've got responsibility to the member as a fiduciary. Industry fund boards, for example, are quite different again. They run a business. They've got the business as well as the fiduciary responsibilities. Is there any observations as to how they would operate differently? Is there any decisions they would make differently? Or
well, first of all, Barry, there's no difference in the legislation. So as far as the legislation is concerned, the same rules apply to all the boards. It's just the way we do things. We obviously are much more significant users of service providers, but we have to have a policy in regard to the service providers we use. We have to obviously, we have a preference for ones within the group, but they have to meet the standards, etc., etc. But if I had to characterise, I mean, most of the boards that I'm involved in, I call compliance boards. Some aren't. I'm a director of Platinum Capital. That's a listed company, and that's a board, a full board. But all these superannuation boards and the advice boards, I call compliance boards. The primary responsibility is we've got to keep the licence, we've got to adhere to the legislative requirements, which in the case of CIS, members' interest, all that kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean that you don't also get the opportunity to give management feedback in regard to their strategy. And the strategy and the compliance have to mesh. Again, I'm picking up what Greg was saying. Best example I could give, Steve Tucker took a leadership position in regard to fees and advice and transparency. He did that because he felt that the advice would not be able to continue to have reputation if we couldn't get rid of the commissions and the bias. That was a strategy that the advice board was totally supportive of. It was his strategy, but we were at one. There wasn't anyone who had a different view in regard to that. I wonder what I would have done as a director of the advice board, I chair it, if, in fact, the strategy was just the reverse. You know, we've got to hang on to commissions till the death, because I don't think the board would have been comfortable with that. We wouldn't have felt we could discharge our compliance responsibilities. So that's how these things do mesh.
But there is an inbuilt tension, isn't there, that the company appoints you to the board and they could take you out. So you're getting an income from this board position, you're getting all the sort of intellectual challenge, you've got a group of people you're working with, you enjoy working with. And if you overstep the line too far, I mean, then the company can take you out. So that must be quite a difficult thing to manage,
It really isn't, because it gets back to, again, we've heard mention reputation.
Yeah.
Your reputation as a director is priceless. And if it's lost, it's lost. And I can remember one of our, you know, some years ago, we had an issue in the superannuation area in regard to unit pricing, and we had an enforceable undertaking. So that was quite a thing to go through. It happened before I joined the board, but the dealing with it was when I was on the board. So I was part of it. And I can remember the independent... We've always had external directors, and we had an independent chairman. And I can remember the independent chairman saying that if this is not dealt with absolutely correctly, this person was a lawyer, and she said, my phone will not ring. In other words, reputation was everything. So she's going to do the right thing by the members and by the duties that she has. The income is immaterial.
Yeah.
And that's why I do believe reputation is so important.
Greg, I'm going to ask you some financial services questions later.
Oh, good.
Later, but not now. When Kodak had their heat matrix, do you think they had everybody goes to digital? Because they've now gone. I mean, they're basically, they used to be everywhere, and now they're almost nowhere.
Absolutely, and you could ask the same question about those who stamp CDs and DVDs. I wonder if anyone could find a different way to get the recorded music. I mean, there's no prescription for perfect decision making, and hindsight is a beautiful thing. But you would have thought that Kodak would anticipate that the digital revolution would make a difference to them. You would have thought that IBM would have moved more quickly into operating systems. The stories are legion, but all we can really say is that a sound enterprise risk management framework should enable better decision making through the provision of better balanced information. But at the end of the day, there's still decisions, aren't there? You sit on a board, you make decisions, and part of that is taking an amount of risk, supposedly within a risk appetite. And like I said, I love that word, risk appetite. There are at least two problems with it. Companies have multiple risk appetites. Yeah? Would you agree with that? Yes. And also, they don't necessarily get to choose their risk appetite if they're suddenly given a task. A council, for example. They may choose to say, gee, I wish we weren't looking after this stretch of coastline. I wish we were a different council. But they don't get to do it. Anyway, don't get me started on risk appetite.
Well, I'll wait a minute because that's the next question, but you keep going.
Oh, there you go. But it's important to articulate it and to regularly review issues to see how they fit within that risk appetite framework. But to go back to your original point, that doesn't mean you're going to get it right all the time. And what you should have is a set of well-articulated indicators to point out that actually we have got it wrong and it's time to change tack. And I think that might be, again, where actuaries can make an excellent contribution.
Yeah. But the other issue for Kodak is that the culture to run a digital business is different to their culture anyway. So maybe they did see it coming and they just accepted they couldn't do anything about it.
Absolutely. Culture trumps all of these things. And I think that was Dick's point too. No amount of measurement, no amount of framework, no amount of documentation will overcome a fundamentally flawed culture. I won't say a rotten one, but I could.
So the question of risk appetite is a question here. I don't quite understand what it means. So I'm hoping I'm just don't understand the terminology. So it says, please expand on risk appetite as an element of institutionalised deception. Do you know what that means?
Yeah, I do.
Explain the question.
That's for you, Greg.
That's a reference to something I said. And I'll quote the fellow I'm thinking of, not because he is an institutional deceiver, but because he's a highly respected person and he had no real choice. His name is Ted Evans. He was outgoing chairman of Westpac. And he said something that I said just a moment ago, which is that that organisations have multiple risk appetites. And in respect of his organisation, he said, we have a high tolerance for financial risk, but zero tolerance for compliance risk. Now, that's very interesting. Thanks to the licensing regime under which banks operate, they're required to maintain something called a breach register. And on that breach register, they record every instance of non-compliance in the course of a period of time. And I can promise you that Westpac's is not empty. So if there was zero tolerance for compliance breaches, there wouldn't be any breaches. What he's really saying is that we robustly deal with compliance breaches as and when they arise. That's what he's really saying. But the language we are forced to use in making risk appetite statements, who is going to say, in representing a financial institution, yep, we've got a huge appetite for compliance breach. Bring it on, because that way we can respond to it and become a better bank. But that is the truth of the matter. Communicating risk appetite can be problematic, particularly given that investors aren't necessarily rational. I'm not the only one, I'm sure, who wants above average rates of return with zero risk of loss of capital. Who's with me? Thank you. But satisfying those fundamentally conflicting objectives is impossible, which leads us to weasel words and some level of misrepresentation, even with the best will in the world, about what our risk appetite actually is. That's what I meant.
Right, okay.
And can I add one thing?
Sure, certainly please. Can.
Just a simple test that we have, and it's really, should I be doing this or should I not? And the test is, just because something might be legal, but it's still, should you be doing it or not? And the test is, it's on the front page of the Financial Review, and there it is explained in all its detail. How do you feel about it? And if you don't feel too good about it, well, then that's telling you something.
Yeah.
And that's been an effective way of, again, simply getting people to think about risk and risk appetite, because it might be legal. It might be going to make, you know, a good return for investors, shareholders, whatever, but how do you feel about it if it's there on the front page of the Financial Review?
For my clients, I use Herald Sun, but yeah, this is financial service.
To you then, Dick, the question you said of culture. I've been in businesses where I've had to report to boards, and we have people coming into the boards and they get grilled, as you say. And these guys are coached within an inch of their life. We say, this is the trustee board. This is what you should say. This is what you shouldn't say. Avoid this topic. We'll rehearse it with you. So when these guys come in to see you, it isn't like they just come in fresh.
One of the things
you
that
know, you would know what they go through before they get to see
and, you. And that's actually one of the benefits of the whole exercise, which I forgot to mention, is the grapevine. They all talk to each other. Yes, they do know what they're going to get asked. But it doesn't take... When you've got someone face-to-face, and these are always face-to-face, and you've got a group of people, including their own senior management, it's very difficult to not be who you are, if I can put it that way. And that's certainly been our experience. And the great beauty of that process is... It isn't just the external directors asking the questions, it's their own management of the dealership and the management of the other dealerships. And, well, as I said, on three occasions it was evident that there were issues, and yet they knew what they were going to be asked. Mm. And, I just don't think it takes long when it's face-to-face and in that kind of environment, and you don't know for sure what you're going to be asked, not be who you are.
Yeah. And I'm sure when they come in, you're all very friendly, aren't you? You shake hands and then you sit them down.
Well, we don't line them up on the wall and start firing bullets at them.
Have a muffin.
No.
Not the orange one.
Part of it is that first up, for 10 minutes or so, they'll just tell us what they're doing.
Yeah.
Unscripted.
Yeah.
So, what comes out? What are their priorities? You know, I mean, it really is a pretty effective...
Yeah.
Means, and it's, as I said, it is all about culture, not just for them, but for the line management, for the ones that they talk to. It's a great way of actually getting the culture that, you know, we want
and
them to do the right thing.
Is that, as a board member, is that your only insight to the culture, or do you have your own networks? Do you mix with them? Are that management happy for you to...
Sure, absolutely. And with advisors. Ask advisors. I've never found an advisor that when you asked them a question didn't tell you plenty. I mean, and people who know advisors here know that. So what do the advisors think of? Because one of the great things about... Because this culture isn't just with the management, it's with the advisors as well. And I can remember years ago, advisors were always pushing us, you know, weaken this dealer standard, or we should be able to do this, or should be able to do that. That's totally changed. Now the advisors are as much a guardian of the reputation as the management and the directors of the licence holder.
Yeah.
Because they know the dangers, they know the damage that a storm financial can do.
Yeah. And so, Greg, you've worked across financial services and non-financial services. You got any observations as to any stark differences between them, or similarities, or different sorts of boards? I mean, Melinda likes saying to me that most of these boards are male, pale and stale.
I just
missed
that.
Oh, did you?
Well, I won't answer that question, although...
Well, you can.
Because I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot of financial services behaviour, as I sort of said at the outset, is now driven a bit more by regulation. In particular in the world of risk, a lot of risk management frameworks are mandated. I could spend a whole half day talking about the positives and negatives of that in terms of board ownership of the risk framework, but that's a story for another day. What I would say, though, is that outside of the financial services arena, in all the boards that I've worked with or trained, I've never met a director whose background was as an actuary. We see a lot of accountants. And a lot of accountants make their way to boards because they see that they can make a contribution to the what used to be called audit committees, now tend to be called risk and audit committees. And what they actually do is to reinforce this detail-oriented, backward-looking, no disrespect to accountants, actually plenty, that stuff, whereas what's really required nowadays is a far more holistic and approach that synthesises a universe of risks in order to... properly pre-digest that for the board. And tell me if you disagree with any of this, by the way. there's a huge contribution to be made, and it astonishes me that I don't see more of you folks out there. That's completely avoiding your question. Is there a difference? Financial services boards in the world of risk seem to be more systematic about it. A lot of non-FS boards that feel they need to do something about risk management because they want to borrow some money or sell the company or they've got somebody to report to will often come to it hastily and come up with a risk inventory that really has little relationship to their business. They don't engage with it as much as they should. So it's an afterthought a lot of the time. I hope that helps to answer.
Yep, so how should actuaries become involved? I mean, do you know enough about actuaries to understand why we are or why we're not involved on these boards?
My daughter-in-law is an actuary.
All right. What's her surname? Is she here?
She's safely in London. So I have interacted with actuaries and I went to a great session today and somebody...
Is she a typical actuary?
Well, she's gorgeous, yeah. And I know a few actuary jokes, but I'm not going to go there either. I went to a session today. I know the guy was tongue-in-cheek when he said this. So when I quote him, I won't name it, but he said, actuaries should get into enterprise risk management because, most of the time for other jobs you're competing with other actuaries and they're all really smart. But in risk management... And I know where he's coming from, and to reverse that, we non-actuaries have that kind of stereotype going in our heads too. These guys are rocket scientists, or the equivalent thereof. We won't understand a word they're saying. They're going to be on some kind of really weird intellectual plane. I'm scared. And one solution to that would be if more actuaries got on boards, and one way to do that is to get on one. Not-for-profit boards are always looking for... That's where I do most of my work. Non-mainstream work, are always looking for a contribution, and I'm convinced that you guys could make a strong contribution, far stronger than a lot of the accountants who come in for the wrong reasons.
What do you think, Vic? Being an actuary on a board?
A lot of the boards that I'm on do have other actuaries, so yeah. I see plenty of actuaries on board.
Yep.
I guess the two things I would say is that I think there's a tremendous contribution actuaries can make, because they're logical thinkers. It's distilling what's the key issue here, what is the key risk, et cetera, et cetera, and then it's being able to effectively communicate that. And that's something that I think, we've put a lot of effort into that in the Institute in recent times, and I think that's been a good thing. Yeah. But, I mean, I think they've got a tremendous amount, a tremendous lot to offer, and I guess I've seen the evidence of it because I've seen them in action.
Yeah. And I did
males and females.
And they're all gorgeous.
Mm.
I did chuckle, Greg, when you talked about the Survey Monkey, because that's exactly what we did in advance of this conference. And we do use it a lot, although I don't think we give anything to council from Survey Monkey, do we? Maybe we do, yeah. So it says... So we ask questions on risk management, and it says 68% of organisations, of people think that organisations put more importance on risk management now than they did, say, 5 years ago. Mm. I'm not sure. Do you see that? And if you do, how does that come through in council papers and time they allocate to it?
Well, 82% of statistics are made up on the spot. But 75% of the time, I'd agree with you. there is clearly a stronger focus on risk management my work with AICD is a perfect example. They didn't have a module on risk in their standard company directors course until 7 years ago. Right, so there you go. That's the national education body for directors suddenly thinking, gee, we need a dedicated module on this. That's not to say that risk wasn't a component of the training and the learning, but it was subsumed under other headings. If you're a not-for-profit enterprise, often you're looking for funding. A lot of that funding comes through philanthropic organisations or governments. All of them are now looking for risk management plans. Ipso facto, you've got to have one. Directors who come to those not-for-profits have come from other walks of life. They've seen the importance of this, and quite frankly, their insurer is asking them as an individual director to make certain attestations about the risk management framework of the companies they direct. For all of those reasons, yeah, there's no question that there's a stronger focus on risk management than there was. I suppose, as the cynic in me says, that could be a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. And a lot of the time it's for the wrong reasons. It ends up with some tick-the-box solutions. Having said that, some good people are doing more thinking about it than they were in the past, so good things are happening.
Well, certainly the regulators pushing more risk management, aren't they, in financial services?
Yep.
I can give you just one little example, which to me says that it is happening. The superannuation trustee boards that I mentioned before, we used to have a risk committee, and then there was a board, and we had investment committee, whatever. We don't have a risk committee anymore. The reason we don't have a risk committee anymore is that the board said this is a key function that we all have to be responsible, accountable for directly. So risk is dealt with by the board.
Right.
Well, I thought that was a pretty clear attestation of how the directors saw their job.
Now, when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, Dick, you said there was a story you'd love to tell us, but you can't. So can you tell us?
You can.
Luckily, I can't remember what it was.
Shame.
It's serious. It's right.
So despite what Dick claims, many boards... Hang on, let me just get this up. Despite what Dick claims, many boards have been deceived by executives resulting in losses, including reputation. What could go wrong? Bad questions, ignorance. Consider the NAB Forex scandal.
Well, if perhaps I could start on that one. I think the key duty of a director is the key thing a board has to be, first of all, is informed. If you're not informed, you can't give good feedback and you certainly can't make decisions. So you do have to be informed. But it's the duty of management to inform, but it's the duty of directors as well. I don't think you can just walk into a place every 3 months, attend a meeting and think, yeah, I'm on top of all this, I know what's going on. So to me, things that would be warning bells, I mean, in our organisation, I can go and talk to anyone in the management team anytime I want to. That's fine. That's encouraged. I can't go in and tell people to do things. That would be not the right use of your director's responsibilities or anything like that. But you can certainly go and ask people questions anytime you want to, talk about issues and so on. That there is that freedom, to me, is an important indicator that here's an organisation that wants to make sure the board is informed. If, I can tell this one. This is a long time ago. I was the managing director of the Australian Bank, which was owned 25% by Lendlease. In the end, that was bought by Tricontinental. That's a name that some of you might remember, which was a subsidiary of the State Bank of Victoria. And that's when I went over to Lendlease. A fellow named Ian Johns, who was the managing director of Tricontinental, Ian Johns went to jail for quite a few years. Some people are nodding, they remember. Ian Johns tried to convince me to stay on in the Australian Bank. Good decision I made. I didn't stay on. But what he said to me was, I said, tell me how you propose to run credit committees and things like that. I'm in Tricontinental, we run the credit committee by phone. So I talk to each of them one by one. Well, there, that's exactly the kind of warning bell that says, here is something that is going to implode, because that is a terrible approach. No director heard any concerns that another director raised, and surprise, surprise, heaven only knows what Tricontinental wrote off, billions. Johns went to jail, the State Bank of Victoria was taken over by the Commonwealth Bank. So a bit happened as a result of a fundamental kind of risk management breakdown. So I believe that good directors and good organisations can be well informed on what's going on. And if the organisation resists open access for directors, that's a kind of a warning sign.
Right. Which seems like it seems like that's not a ticker box issue, is it? That's actually a personality issue. I think last time we had the Financial Services Forum, we had Simon Longstaff from St James Ethics Centre, and he has this presentation called Tiger in the Room. And what he says there is that the more compliance process and ticker box you have, it creates a false sense of security that you've you've got yourself protected, and you've actually always got to look outside. And that's the same for, you know, the US banking crisis. That seems to be a similar thing there. So just quickly then, last question really, or a couple of questions here. How do you judge success of ERM?
Well, the success of enterprise risk management would be measured in the same way as any other investment of the board. You would, I can't answer that question in the general sense. You would simply say that you would expect to see an improvement in certain indicators. And to go back a step, one of the big problems with risk generally is measuring absences. The problem with key risk indicators is that you, in order to create a measurement, you're measuring proxies for events. In my world, where most of my practice is around marketing compliance or foreign corrupt practices, you know when the risk is materialised because you're being prosecuted. The bits in between, when you're not being prosecuted, you might be very good and you might be very lucky. It might depend entirely on the regulator's resources. And so what companies look for is proxies for that. They measure, you know, a number of training sessions run. They run cultural surveys. They look for these things. Many of these indicators are kind of lame. So to answer the question, the two-step process would be, firstly, to devise some real indicators around threats and indeed opportunities, but in this instance, threats, and then look for improvement in those indicators. And again, if I'm sounding like a broken record, this is where you guys can really help. Not so much in the area of measuring financial success or progress or failure, but these measuring absences in... measuring the absence of problems in a realistic way would be very helpful, but I don't know how you do it. That's why I came along today. I know somebody's going to tell me. Going to tell me.
Well, only in the world of advice, that we have had no systemic issues. We've had no, you know, ASIC coming in, putting enforceable undertakings on us in terms of an advice business. We've had, obviously, issues. You've got to get on the front foot, you deal with them, and so on. The other measure to me, so that's the most important measure, but the other measure is the core data survey, which rates all of the advisor business based on the feedback of the clients and the experience that the clients have had. And our dealerships have either, you know, rated the top of that or near the top of that just about every time it's been done. So you do have to have measures which give you some confirmation that you're on the right track, that you're not kidding yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. I should have said benchmarking. But then that begs the question, benchmarking what? And, yeah, good point. But benchmarking is how you measure those successes, yeah.
Okay, I think we're just about out of time. So could you please join me in thanking our two speakers? Thank you. And before you leave, I've got a couple of presents for you. Okay, so that's it from me. Anyway, after I almost accidentally opened the conference, I'm now going to definitely hand over to David Goodsall to close the conference. It's been fantastic, I think, certainly from my perspective, it's been fantastic, and you're a great, actuaries are a great crowd, always a great crowd, very smart and involved. And so with that, I'll say thank you, and I'll hand over to David. Thank you.
Don't forget your iPad, Barry. Don't forget your iPad. There you go. I nearly got another one. Okay, great. Actuaries make assumptions, and I'm afraid, Dick, you made an invalid assumption. I am the one that is standing between everyone and the bus. And the bus, which leaves at 6 p.m. from the main foyer, so we've got plenty of time. Don't panic, and I have to leave before the bus anyway, so you're safe. The Institute supports research activities, and we consider that they're essential for the long-term development of the profession. And as I mentioned yesterday, the Institute Research Council Committee has created the Financial Services Research Prize, which is a cash prize of $2,500 and is being awarded for the first time today. We hope the prize will encourage the preparation of papers as opposed to just presentations at these forums, because these are more readily disseminated and allow the participants to have thought about the issues before the presentation and encourage better conversations. And we look forward to hopefully a bit of an increased proportion of papers at future forums. But more formally, the prize is to promote and recognise research with a focus on results that are of direct relevance to practising professional actuaries. The prize is awarded for the paper the Risk Council Committee considers best achieves the following criteria. Has immediate usefulness for practising actuaries. Is in a format that could be readily submitted for publication to an industry or academic journal. Achieves acceptance, endorsement and or encouragement from those attending its presentation at the forum. And has a high standard of presentation, logic and clarity. Now, the committee's been working hard going through all these I think the criteria of acceptance to presentation is important. I've just been looking at some of the online feedback for the winner, which was very good. So you've, I think, endorsed the committee's selection. So I'm pleased to announce that the winners of the inaugural Financial Services Research Prize are Ramani and Victor Chandra for their paper, Actuarial Challenges in Defined Contribution Schemes. And I'd like to invite Ramani up to accept the prize. Okay, we're almost at the end. And while I make a few remarks, could I ask the organising committee and the Institute team, Institute employees, the extended ones, so Julie, you can't stay, but down the back, just to quietly make their way up to the front. So the theme of the forum is Think Big. And Think Big we have. We started hearing about creativity and fear and Tob Sampson's view that we need to change the education of our children. The Institute wants to unleash the creativity of our members and believes that we need to equip the profession better to meet the needs of our customers. So we're looking into revising our education to do just that. We've heard about economic problems in Europe and the change in Australia's exports after the minerals run out. We've heard about longevity and the issues that are here now in providing worthwhile retirement income solutions and the advice and product needs of the potential retirees. These are big issues that need to be worked on now, and we need to be planning for the future implications. I must say I'm a bit dubious about Barry's solution of putting his head in a vat of red wine, attached to the matrix, drawing the old age pension, but you've got to admit it's certainly creative. Now, we saw the impact of the digital world as it is now, is about to be, and may be in the future, and how some actuaries are embracing the possibilities at times with other professionals. And this is great. It's what we need to do. We saw many actuaries who are being more than an actuary. Keep that up. We opened with creativity and the need to take a risk and be brave for 5 minutes longer. And I'd like to leave you with a modified quote from Sean McGing's paper, so I hope Sean will forgive me. And that is, go boldly forth and thou shalt learn and add value. Do not be afraid. Now, before I leave the stage, I have one last important duty, and that's to say some thank yous. Thank you to our silver sponsors, Towers Watson and RGA, for your terrific support over the last 2 days, and we look forward to a continued association in the future. Your significant support is very, very much appreciated. To DW Simpson, Swiss Re and Matt Noyce Consulting for the practical goodies, and also thanks go to KPMG, Deloitte and Milliman for their support. A special thank you goes to all the plenary speakers, of which I think there's some 40-odd people who've contributed their time to this event. A very big thank you also to Barry. Where are you, Barry? There he is. Yes, who has ably chaired the 6 plenary sessions, and of course a very big thank you to all those who took the time to present or chair a concurrent session or participate in the discussions. Now, last but definitely not least, a lot of work goes into preparing this event, and I'm sure you'll agree with me it's been outstanding. Outstanding attendance. We still have an outstanding attendance, which is always a great sign. So in just a moment, I'd like you to join me in giving a big thank you, of course, to all the members of the 2011 Organising Committee, of which we have a few, and the Institute staff. So please take a bow, and I'll mention even those who aren't here, Wade Mattison, John Newman, Nicolette Rubenstein, Adam Drusey, Rob Daly, Kent Griffin, Sean McGing, Tim Gorst, Ismar Trusvik, Melinda Howes, and her team, Emma Simonson, Lisa Prenetti, Ennis Hemmed, Heather Whitnall, and the ever-present Julia Purvis. I have to single out because she hates it. And, of course, to all the other secretariat staff who contributed to this event. So join me in thanking them all. I'm required by law to tell you the evaluation form should be filled out before you leave, or you can do it online. And on that, thank you very much. We'll close the forum, and I look forward to seeing you all again in 2014. Travel safely.